We're doing the years of silence. We are going to do something a little bit different this evening. If you've been here for each of the classes, you might have gotten used to the fact that I lecture a lot and I tell you a lot of things and give you dates. It was all building up to something. I thought I'd get to it last week, but then I thought we were getting close to the end of time. And I actually want to take my time over the next portion because I want you to see the application of all these things. We're going to be talking about the material from the Lesson 5 handout in a few minutes, maybe towards the end of class. Depends how much interaction I can get from you. I want to remind you of a few things we had talked about last week, sort of to set the stage again. We were discussing the period of the great persecution under Antiochus Epiphanes. We pointed out last week that there were basically anywhere from 3 to 5 things you could do, and that people did, as you would expect, all of them, in face of the persecution. That is, we discussed, anyone remember some of the ones we did last week? What were some of the reactions you could have to persecution? You could fight. Hey, we're going to start with fight this time. All right. You could flee. You could submit. You can die. And the one that was similar to flee that we came up with, sort of our fifth, was you could flee but not so far, or what I was calling withdraw. You could just try to hide out and to ride it out. And those are basically, unless somebody came up with a sixth one. Anyone come up with a sixth one, Derek? Those are the only ones I could come up with. The only ones I'll be talking about, most of them, this evening. I'm going to hold off on what I consider flee, that is, flee the country, for a couple more lessons. We'll come to those who fled the country in a different lesson. I haven't quite decided whether it be next week or the week after. Well, it won't be next week, but it may be the week after or maybe one after that. But we will get to those who fled the country. But we're going to look at sort of the other reactions and how they sort of manifest themselves when we get to the New Testament. In the time of the persecution, we'll start with fight. Because that's what we talked about. We talked about those who fought, and who did they fight under? Anyone remember the name? The Maccabees. Judas the Maccabee, meaning the hammer. He's the one who led the fight, those who took up arms and decided to struggle. Well, just think about, and we started last week moving beyond the fight of the Maccabees, and we moved into the Hasmonean dynasty, or as I pointed out, it might have originally been the Hasmonean, that is, it was a dynasty founded by Judas's brother, Simon, passed from Simon to his son, John Hyrcanus. Both of them, Simon and his son, taking both the high priesthood and the kingship, combining them. And then John Hyrcanus tried to split them up, and that caused all kinds of family problems, and Aristobulus murdering his mother, and then getting killed himself or dying himself before his brother takes the throne. And his brother has the same idea when he's getting to the end of his life. Maybe he should split up this priesthood and kingship. It seems to be causing a lot of strife. You know, it's a lot of power in one man's hands. Well, think about those who had the attitude of fight, the Maccabees. And in fact, the people took that name, those who followed Judas. They called themselves the Maccabees. You know, they're sort of naming themselves after their leader. Well, as time goes on, there's other confrontations that come about. You move from the Greeks, that's who the Maccabees fought. What next major political group comes to invade? Next empire after the Greeks? The Romans are going to come. And we're going to talk about the Romans at least a little bit next week, and we may even do another lesson on them as well. But if you were the Maccabees, going to put you on the spot, how would you feel about Romans coming in? or if you were the descendants, because it's, you know, it's 50 to 100 years later before the Romans come in, so, you know, you're not the ones who actually fought, but, you know, it's your grandpa, maybe, great-grandpa. But if you've sort of heard those stories, what might you do when the Romans come in and invade? Take up your sword and say, hey, grandpa did it. We can do it. All right, let's fight again. And why? What are you fighting for then? To stay independent. You're fighting for, we have a word for it in English, right? Freedom, liberty, patriotism, right? That's sort of where I'm thinking of. Patriots. Those who are fighting for their country. All right? It's our country, these invaders, right? And so some of the Maccabees, their descendants, sort of take up this idea that this is our country, this is our land, Judea, and we're going to fight people who try to take it away from us. Under the Hasmoneans, they kind of adopted the Hasmonean. I mean, you know, they were our people. They were Jews. The Maccabees, who sort of had this idea of patriotism as the cause for fighting, were okay with that, but when the Romans come in, they start fighting the Romans. And I guess they were probably surprised, 64 BC, when the Romans come in, 63 BC. There weren't a lot of people. It wasn't like, well, actually, it probably was a lot like the first days of the Maccabean revolt, where it was just the father and his five sons running into the woods. But they never actually got a great big following, right? The Maccabees, you know, first tens and then hundreds of people started going out to join them. Well, it didn't happen quite that way for the patriots as they thought of themselves. As the Romans took control, they started doing quiet rebellion, is what they called it. That is, well, we may not be able to be like Judas Maccabee and go out and knock down great big boulders and smash Roman armies. But, you know, if that Roman soldier gets drunk and he's walking down the street by himself, they weren't afraid to go over and stab him in the back. Right, assassinate them. So they started doing assassinations. They started moving around, and they did try a few insurrections, see if they could get some popular uprisings, see if they could get the people stirred up. A few of them actually get kind of mentioned in passing in the New Testament. Anyone remember one of them that gets mentioned? Almost offhand by Jesus. Do you think those Galileans who got their blood mingled with the sacrifices? Right, he's talking about one of the insurrections, a time where the zealots had stirred up the people during a temple ceremony to try a rebellion, and they got slaughtered. Pilate was, you know, was not afraid to march his soldiers right into the temple courtyard and, you know, slaughter whoever was causing a problem. Jesus said the lesson there was rebel, right? What did he say the lesson was? Repent. Or you too might likewise perish, right? You know, life's short. He doesn't actually speak out against them. I point out there's at least a couple of people who are probable. One we're told is a zealot. Simon the Zealot. He's mentioned twice by that name. Who was Simon the Zealot? One of the apostles. Can you believe Jesus picked a zealot as an apostle? Simon Zelotes, some translations put it, but that's what Zelotes means, the zealot. He was identified as a zealot. Not a zealot for Christ. He was a zealot as a, basically we'd say, a political party, a patriot. Why would that be surprising? Right, that's one of the people the zealots liked to kill was tax collectors. You know, they worked for the enemy, they worked for Rome. Jesus picks both a tax collector and a zealot, puts them together, and they get along. All right, They both are apostles. They both continue to follow Christ. So he sort of picked from two extremes as far as people would see them. The other probable zealot I put up there is Barabbas. We all know Barabbas, right? Who is Barabbas? An insurrectionist murderer. Mark 15, verse 7. There was one named Barabbas who was chained with his fellow rebels. They had committed murder in the rebellion. All right, that's the description of him. He was a rebel. He was chained with his fellow rebels. They were in an insurrection. It's another one of those probable times where they attempted. It's interesting. Pilate thought so little of the rebellion that in general he just didn't even bother mentioning it in his reports to Rome. You know, it's probably no different than most other rebellions. He mentions a few times those that got kind of big into the hundreds, but when they stay kind of small, Pilate doesn't even seem to mention that, you know, oh yeah, I had to kill a bunch of people. You know, that's just the way it was. But we know this happened all throughout Pilate as well as the years before. And the reason was these zealots. So they were fighting for their country, and we see that even in the New Testament, they were going to still be there fighting for their country. But not all the Maccabee followers, or would-be followers, you know, sort of theological followers or philosophical followers, I guess. Those who were fighting, not all of them were fighting for their country. Why else might somebody be fighting? Okay, yeah, there could be the mercenaries. Don't know that we had any in the first century as far as those who joined the rebellion. Certainly those the Greeks brought in, the Romans brought in mercenaries. What else might you be fighting for? If you're fighting for a principle or a cause.
For the honor of my family.
Okay, it could be for honor. Anyone got any other things that you would fight for? Okay, for loot, plunder, money. What was the other? Peer pressure. Yeah, you could be fighting because other people are fighting. Fear. You could fight for fear. None of them are quite the group I'm thinking of. How about fighting for, you ever heard the expression, my president, right or wrong? Fighting because, hey, this is the people we put in charge. If he says go fight, we go fight. Because that's how a lot of the Maccabees ended up. They became a different group. You'd think they're the same thing, right? Is fighting for your country the same as fighting for your leaders? Not necessarily. Right? Because your leaders might go in a different direction than... Because after the Hasmoneans, we haven't gotten to them yet, but after the Hasmonean dynasty, who comes next? New Testament figure. We'll talk about him in a different lesson, but who's the next big king? Herod. And who is Herod? An Idumean, not a Jew. We talked about the Idumeans a little bit. Remember John Hyrcanus? He went to Edom and he forced all the men of Edom to be circumcised. Those were the Idumeans. So they were kind of Jews. Not necessarily well accepted in Judaism. Now these people, there were a group of people fighting for their leaders, and so when the Maccabees went to the Hasmonean dynasty, they were fighting right alongside the Zealots. Zealots were fighting because the Hasmoneans were leaders for their country. This other group was fighting because the Hasmoneans were their leaders. Just plain and simple. These are the people in charge. But when the Romans came in and they put Herod in charge, the Zealots were out there, well, let's kill Herod, you know, if we can, and let's kill the people who follow Herod and Herod's followers just as easily as they killed Roman followers. But there were others who said, hey, Herod's in charge now. We fight for Herod. Because we're just following the next dynasty. What name do we have for the group that followed the Herods? It's an easy one. Herodians. All right, just stick an I-A-N on the end of it. The Herodians. They followed them. They basically had sort of the idea of a divine right of kings, you know. These are the ones God put in charge. It was the Hasmoneans, we followed them. Now it's the Herodians, we follow them. And the Herodians then, how do you think they got along with the Romans? They were okay with them. I mean, Rome is who put Herod in charge. So, you know, they didn't have any issue with them. And therefore, our two groups so far, Zealots and Herodians, how well they get along. They're both fighters. Both people want to take up arms. How would you imagine they got along? Not very good, yeah. The Zealots saw the Herodians as, you know, collaborators with the enemy. The Herodians saw the Zealots as trying to overthrow the rightful king. All right, so they were out to get each other. Go ahead and be turning your Bible to these couple passages. We have two incidents in the New Testament that mention the Herodians. We'll start with Mark chapter 3, verse 6. Whoever's got that, go ahead and read it for us. Okay. We'll get to the Pharisees next, if you see how ironic this is. But here we've got yet a different group joining the Herodians. Why would the Herodians want to get rid of Jesus? This is early in the ministry. This is after one of the various healings on the Sabbath. That's why the Pharisees are involved. But why would they join the Herodians? What position is Jesus holding? Who is Jesus? Yeah, he's another king. He's another power. He's wanting to upset the Herods. And if you believe the Herods are there as a divine right of kings, then, you know, you might think, well, that's not a very Jewish mindset. But, you know, a lot of years have gone by. We've had 400 years of silence. This particular group has come to the decision that the right thing is to follow the leaders. And therefore, Jesus is upsetting that, just as he did to Herod, right? Herod's idea was, where's the king, you know, where's he who's born king of Israel going to be, you know? Bethlehem. Oh, good. Tell me to come and worship him, you know? And what he'd really want to do? Kill him, because he's a rival king. All right? That hasn't gone away. The other incident, somebody read for us, Mark 12, 13 to 17. Okay, they sent the Pharisees and Herodians. The Herodians are there. Well, let's take the Pharisees first. What are the Pharisees there to represent? Which viewpoint? The question is, shall we pay taxes? Which viewpoint are they? Presumably, you'd almost think they would have sent the Zealots and the Herodians, but they might have killed each other while they're on their way. Which viewpoint is the Pharisees coming with? Should we pay taxes to Caesar? No, they're not going to be in favor. We'll talk about why on the next slide. They're not going to be in favor of the paying taxes to Caesar. What about the Herodians? Yeah, they're in power. They're part of that power structure that gets paid, actually, from the taxes that go to Caesar. Assuming they're actually Herodians officially, you know, there would be those who are unofficial, just, you know, chose to fight with him. But others actually would have joined Herod, become part of his guard. He kept a lot of guards. So what's the point? They're saying, you know, Jesus, no matter what you say, there's somebody here who's going to get mad at you. Somebody here who's going to be able to charge you with something, right? If you go with the no taxes, the Herodians can go running back to their masters and say, he said no taxes. You know, if you say to pay taxes, the Pharisees are going to go tell the people that you're, you know, stir up the zealots. Maybe the zealots will assassinate, you know, Jesus. Pharisees are going to say, hey, this guy, you know, he's saying pay taxes. Jesus' point was that the coin belongs to Caesar. It has his image. It has his name. That's a superscription there. Right? His name is there. His image is there. That's obviously his. I don't know if you missed the point when he says to God the things that are God's. There's somewhere else that has God's image. Something that was made with God's image and that has God's name. We are, or we should be, right? We all bear the image of God, and we should bear the name of God. And if you're God's, then you give to God the things that's God's. That's you. And as far as the coin, God doesn't care. You know, if God wanted coins, God would have made coins. You know, it doesn't have his name. Give it to the guy who made it. And they marveled. They said, you know, wow, that was a great answer. Neither party could really get mad because, you know, yes, that means taxes are going to be paid, and the Pharisees can't get mad because he's telling them, you belong to God. That's what God wants. But those were the two fighting parties. We talked about one of the parties that chose to, somebody mentioned earlier, to die. Anyone remember what we mentioned them? It's still a form of Judaism today. Hasidic, right? The Hasid, the pure, that's what their name meant. Well, just like the Maccabees sort of became two parties, we'll talk about two parties that come out of the Hasidic idea. And we'll start with the Pharisees. We already know them. They chose a different name. Hasid was already taken. They were those who remained Hasid, pure. But they chose a similar name, the name that we call Pharisee, which is taking the Hebrew name, changing it, transliterating it into Greek, and then transliterating it into English, and it loses something in the translations. But its root word might be familiar to you from our class, or actually Scott's part of the class in Daniel. Daniel chapter 5. He reads the handwriting on the wall and it said, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. The root word is Upharsin. Anyone remember what that last word meant? Weighed, counted, divided. It means those divided or those separate. Now you sort of see the idea. We separate ourselves. That's the idea of the party name for the Pharisees. We're the separate ones. What's another idea of being separate? What's another word? Huh? Sanctified or holy. All right? So they're basically saying the same thing as the Hasidic were. You know, we're sanctified, we're holy, we're set apart. We've divided ourselves from everybody else. They started basically during the reign of John Hyrcanus. They separated themselves from the Hasidic, the rest of those. They said they were the more pure. That was the idea of the Pharisees. They thought the Hasidic were going in the wrong direction. They wanted to be more pure in their own ideas. They didn't want any wars of expansion. That's why they started to form. They were trying to say to John Hyrcanus, you know, this is our country. We don't need you going to other countries. Remember, he went into Edom, and he went across into the Transjordan, and he went into Samaria, and the Pharisees didn't like any of that. They didn't like that he was both high priest and king. Some of those sentiments began even during his father's reign as high priest and king. And since they didn't like that, then the Hasmoneans, the kings, obviously didn't like the Pharisees very much. Sort of at first because they were just a nuisance. The Pharisees were always complaining that you're not doing this scripturally. You know, you're not following the law. You're not even descendant of, who do you have to be a descendant of to be a high priest? Aaron, you know, that the Hasmoneans were Levites, but they weren't descendants of Aaron. And more particularly, since the days of David, you had to be a descendant of Zadok. And you're certainly not a son of Zadok because they're all dead. So the Pharisees were really, you know, sort of on the case of the kings. And every time there seemed to be a weakness, there were the Pharisees. And so for a while, Pharisees became the allies of not the Herodians, but zealots. All right, they had a common enemy, all right, these kings. They continued the practice of the Hasid of teaching in villages. The Hasid actually had withdrawn further, and we'll talk about them later. They had stopped this practice. The Pharisees continued it. Let's get to the people. Right? The Hasid did this all through the Maccabean War. The Pharisees continued. Let's get to the people. Let's talk to them in their villages. Let's keep people there who would influence them. Tell them that they need to be pure. Build, their own words, build a hedge around the law. All right. Tell them to keep away from any sin. They continued the idea that people should practice not only what the children of Israel were told to practice, but to live by the priestly standards. That was something they still had in common with the Hasid. They both taught that. Josephus, who was a Pharisee, so he's not trying to, you know, put them down. Josephus actually is very proud of the fact that there were about 5,000 Pharisees, true Pharisees, in the New Testament times. That might make you think, oh, it sounds kind of low, right? At least it did the first time I read it in Josephus. I scratched my head and go, what? Only 5,000? And what he means is only 5,000 true, pure Pharisees. Not just 5,000 who leaned Pharisee. But, you know, there's a difference between leaning, you know, I guess we could compare it to like political parties, right? You might lean one way or another, but actually not join the party, right? You might vote with them and, you know. You might even occasionally call yourself one without actually joining the party. Because, you know, people who join the party, you might think, eh, they're a little bit, you know. So the Pharisees were actually not that big of a group, 5,000 people. But they employed 25,000 scribes in the first century. So the scribes, what did they teach? The doctrine of the Pharisees. Obviously, they're the ones who are paying them. That gets back to the money idea, right? Those who do things for money. The scribes were in this for the cash. They were paid. This was their job. Their job was to go into the villages and teach Pharisaical doctrine. They became the school teachers, basically. Right? Like itinerant school teachers in the old times. Right? They'd go from village to village. Usually they would settle in a village. The Pharisees would install them, pay them a salary. You stay here and teach them to be good Pharisees. Most people didn't become Pharisees. Most people just considered themselves to be Jews, but they started sort of to practice the things of Pharisees. Things like can't walk more than 1/8 of a mile on the Sabbath day. Nowhere in Scripture does it say that. That was a Pharisee teaching. Right? Pharisees had invented something, installed it, taught it to people decade after decade, teacher after teacher. All teach them the same thing. People came to believe. Okay, well, you know, that's what it says. And therefore, in Judaism, there's a huge collection of the doctrines, mostly of the Pharisees. They were started to be collected about 100 years after Christ. They started writing them all down in 90 AD, and it took them over 100 years to write them all down. Volume after volume of all the things that the Pharisees, their teachers, had come up with. These are the Talmud, the Jews. It's all the teachings about the law. It's not the law. Right? It's all the teachings we've come up with. It includes, one of the most impressive, it includes 8 entire volumes on what you can and cannot do on the Sabbath day. Right? All based on, you shall not work on the Sabbath day. Hey, they got 8 volumes out of that. Because it includes everything from how far you can walk. Are there exceptions? And there are exceptions. You can only walk 1/8 of a mile, but if you have another home in 1/8 of a mile, you can go 1/8 of a mile further. So, carry a tent, go 1/8 of a mile, pitch your tent, say, here's my home, pack up your tent, move another 1/8 of a mile, pitch your tent. You can keep going. They had all kinds of these rules and exceptions. This was the Pharisees and the scribes. And therefore, usually in the New Testament, when the Pharisees are there talking to Jesus, it's the scribes and the Pharisees, or the Pharisees and the scribes, right? 2 groups that really are one group. Who's probably one of the more famous Pharisees of the New Testament? He was a Pharisee of Pharisees. Paul! Right? Paul says that he was a Pharisee among Pharisees. That is, he's claiming he was a true Pharisee. He was a party loyalist. Right? He was in this party. Well, who do we think of sort of on the opposite side from the Pharisees? Paul used this a lot when he... Sadducees, right? We'll start with the name. Anyone ever given any thought to the name Sadducee? And no, I don't mean, there's a preacher thing, you know. You can remember them because the Pharisees believed in a lot of things, and that's fair, you see, and then, you know. Sadducee, no, that isn't what the name means. And again, it's a corruption, just like Upharsis has become corrupted in Pharisee. The name Sadducee went from the Hebrew to the Greek, from the Greek to English, transliterated twice. Actually, some of the sounds got changed a little bit. The name in Hebrew, anyone want to guess what it is? The Hebrew name is Zadokim. Now, with that pronunciation, you might have a better idea of what it means. Zadokim, making it plural. They're saying they were from Zadok. Can also be translated either the Zadoks, plural, or the sons of Zadok. And that's usually how they were the party of Zadok. You can already guess who they are, right? If you're claiming to be the party of Zadok, you're claiming you're the priests. All right? We already know all the sons of Zadok are actually dead. But kind of like, if you know American history, mid-1800s, there was a big party called the Jeffersonians. Right? They weren't actually claiming they were. They were Thomas Jefferson, but they were claiming they had his principles. Right. Well, these were actually claiming first they had the principles of Zadok, but they were actually claiming they were sons of Zadok. Because, this is that strange circular reasoning, they were the priest. And if the priest, then they're sons of Zadok. And if they're sons of Zadok, then they're priests. Right? They sort of justified their own priesthood. And we'll talk more about the priesthood later. It might surprise you, though, that they weren't a religious party at all. They were a political party. They were formed by the Hasmonean kings to oppose the Pharisees. They did a really good job forming that political party because the opposition was still going strong 150 years later. Or actually about 100 years later. John Hyrcanus is the one who seems to have formed the Sadducees. Sons of Zadok originally included the Hasmonean kings. Of course, they eventually die out. They were mostly Hellenists, which is kind of odd because the Hasmoneans had fought the Greeks, but they had started, remember, that's how Simon became high priest. It was a vote, right? They did a Greek thing. They were sort of fighting the Greeks, but yet adopting Greek customs, Greek way of life. The wealthy and powerful started paying to become part of the party. Right? Political donations. We'll give you money. What king doesn't like getting money, right? That's part of being a king. You got all kinds of expenses. These people paid, and they paid richly to be called a son of Zadok. All right? They got the high positions in the administration. They got, you know, advisorships. They got to be on that board we talked about, that ruling council, that name was going to become, by New Testament times, Sanhedrin, all right? President of it, of course, back then was the king, right? It was just an advisory board to the king. Its makeup was going to change. New Testament times, and remember, Josephus, who wrote this, was a Pharisee, so he may have been downplaying the size of the Sadducees, but he says there was about 400 Sadducees. And that seems to actually be kind of accurate, because of the number of people who called themselves sons of Zadok. Seems to be very small. And where did they all live? You could probably guess. In and around Jerusalem. Right? Because if you're a son of Zadok, then you're tied to the temple. Right? If you're a rich, wealthy person, you're sort of tied to the seat of power. Right? Jerusalem. Religiously, Sadducees are actually, we'd probably call secular humanists, because they weren't religious at all, which is kind of funny because they're the high priests, or become high priests. But they weren't religious. They didn't believe in spiritual things. They believed in money. They believed in power. Right? The religious part, we'll talk more about it next week, the religious part was simply a way of exercising power. And therefore, they didn't believe in what sorts of things. I gave you some scriptures if you don't know them. Let's go ahead and somebody read the one in Acts there. Acts 23, 6 to 8. I think that's the one that gives the longer list. Okay. Yeah, there's the long list we normally think of as defining Sadducees. And, you know, sometimes we think of it and we say, well, somehow religiously they came to the idea there's no, you know, no angels, no spirit, no resurrection. My point is, it wasn't religious at all. They weren't looking at Scripture and trying to decide, ooh, does this mean there is or isn't? Because they're not a religious group. They're a political group. They had no interest in religious things. It'd be like, you know, asking an atheist, you know, do you believe in, you know, angels and spirits and resurrection? They'd be going, what, are you crazy? Right? These guys were after power and money. They didn't believe in any of those stuff. They didn't try to follow the law. They weren't trying to teach people to be good Jews, you know, and follow God. Right? They were trying to see how they could use this for power and political gain. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it is strange. I mean, because, you know, we think about religion or faith in terms of spiritual things, but I'm not even sure he believes in a universal God. Okay? But Judaism is still very important.
Right.
It's like a tradition, and he's kosher. You know, he'll do the Hanukkah thing, and, you know,
because it's a. A ritual, it's a practice, yeah. And that's the way, what Jim's saying, for those who couldn't hear it. He's saying, you know, it's much like secular Judaism today. There's still a lot of Jews, especially even in Israel, who don't really practice Judaism in the biblical sense. But rather, they practice all those traditions, the Talmud. They've learned the traditions, they do the traditions, not because of some religious or spiritual connection, but simply because they're a Jew, and, you know, that's what Jews do. We do these things. And, you know, really, they're sort of the philosophical descendants of the Sadducees. The Sadducees actually get wiped out completely because there are so few of them. They die off in this, the Jewish War, 70 AD. But, you know, that sort of mindset has remained and still popular.
Well, I'm actually heard, I don't know if this is how close the statistic is, but like 80% of the people in Israel today are basically atheists.
Right. Yeah, a large part, and I agree, a large part of Jews in Israel don't actually practice Judaism in a religious sense. That might also be true of Catholics, you know. And, you know, there are a large number of people who claim, you know, a religion and practice certain things, not because they believe the spiritual part, but because, you know, hey, that's what we do. This is who we are. We grew up. We know these things. You know, a lot of people, you know, another society might look at, you know, America and say, look at all the people who, you know, practice Christmas, but who don't believe in Christmas the way that the Catholics believe in Christmas, yet they still continue the traditions that, you know, it'd be kind of the same thing. Hey, we've become secularized, right? That's the way the Sadducees were. They were sort of secular Judaists. They still practiced, you know, they were still priests. They were there in the temple. They were killing the animals. They were putting them up on the altar. Why would they be doing all that stuff if they didn't believe religiously? It was their livelihood, their job. You know, this is what we do. Okay, you know, if we're going to be Zadokim, then we're the ones who have to do the temple stuff. Now, there were real sons of Aaron out there, like Zacharias. And they took turns by the New Testament time coming through. They never got the high priesthood. But they took turns in the temple, right? High priesthood was only for the, you know, the important people. Especially by New Testament times. The Zadokim weren't going to do the common chores around the temple. So they brought in Levites and, you know, sons of Aaron. They could do those things. We're only going to do the important things. We'll be out there for the important rituals. We'll be out there to, the meet and greet, you know, glad hand the crowd, you know. We'll talk more about the high priesthood. Don't want to talk too much about it. We'll have another lesson involving that. When the Pharisees, under Alexander, that was the son, the brother of Aristobulus. Remember, Aristobulus killed his mother. Alexander became high priest. The Pharisees actually demanded when he first became high priest as well as king that he separate the two as his father had wished. The Sadducees, as you could almost guess, demanded, no, you keep it. You know, it's got to stay with us. We're the Zadokim. Alexander obviously stayed with the Sadducees. The Pharisees actually, for once, led an open revolt. They, you know, all those people they had been teaching, you know, quietly for almost 80 years at this point. Let's fight the king. The one thing they forgot was they weren't fighters. it was a slaughter. They didn't really have anything to go on. And all the fighters, zealots and Herodians, were all on the side of the kings at that point. And the Pharisees lost that. And it brings us to the last group for the last 5 minutes. This was our reading. The Essenes. This is another horrible mistranslation, mispronunciation of the name. Anyone want to guess what the name? Most likely, no one's even certain that it's the true pronunciation because the word Essene doesn't really mean anything in. It's right there in the first line. It's taking Hasidim. Most people think. Changed it into Greek to what the Greeks thought it meant to English. It's become Essene rather than Hasidim. Most people think these are the real purists, the ones who had been there. And what did they do when Judas fought? They went off and hid. And now when they're fighting the Romans, what do the Essenes do? They go off and hide. They withdraw. These are the withdrawal people. Let's just stay away. We'll pretend they're not there. We'll go into our little corner and we'll stay here and hopefully things will work its way out. They chose the corner next to the, what sea?
Dead Sea.
Dead Sea. That's the picture there in the corner of the ruins that are there next to the Dead Sea, the Qumran settlement. These are the people who hid what we call the Dead Sea Scrolls into the caves. That was their storage system. And they had actually different caves for different kinds of literature. It's kind of like a library. They had certain caves, very deep caves, very well insulated caves, where they kept scripture. They had different caves where they kept religious literature. They had different caves where they kept commentaries on religious literature and on the scripture. And they had other caves that seemed to have been just things like receipts. They've only found scraps because they didn't really keep those things very well. They were just kind of sitting in shallow caves. And you can see a few markings on it. So obviously there were some they didn't care about, and some they cared about greatly. Some that were religious literature is what I had you read for last week, this week. The first was the War Rule Scroll. If you had a chance to read the War Rule Scroll, what's it all about? If you could figure it out from the little reading. I only gave you a little portion. It's a really long thing. I had to read it once. It's kind of repetitious. It's trying to lay out the sons of light and sons of darkness. We're going to fight the sons of darkness. They saw themselves as the sons of light. And we're going to get prepared and we're going to have our army ready. And it's not much in this section, but when a teacher of righteousness or the teacher of righteousness appears, we're going to be ready to go to war on his side and we're going to defeat the sons of darkness. Well, what does that sound like? Okay, might sound like the second coming of Christ. The idea of the sons of light and sons of darkness. You know, Paul talks about the same ideas, right? We're sons of light, they're sons of darkness. There's some parts of the War Rule, if you read the whole thing, sounds like the Armageddon kind of literature. That is, they're saying, okay, when the battle happens, then you'll line up on this side, and he'll line up over here, and these armies will be over here, and we'll all come together and have a big fight. Briefly, the one on the back, he had a chance to read it from the Jubilee Scroll. Everybody remember Jubilee, right? Comes every 50 years. What were they expecting on a Jubilee? The ninth Jubilee. They even gave a number. They didn't say where it started, though. Who were they expecting? They give two names to them. One of them's the Messiah. They quote Daniel chapter 9 very appropriately. And actually, if you count it, they say nine jubilees, 9 times 50, 450. They have almost got the right number of years from Daniel. 490 would have been Daniel, but you know that didn't quite work out for them. And who else were they expecting? And it might be the same person, depending how you read the Melchizedek. They were pretty close, weren't they? They talk about Melchizedek coming and Messiah coming in both the same context. I find it interesting. You know, these things, you know, they could figure these things out. Not quite right, right? But sometimes we have this idea that Jews didn't have any idea what was going on. Right? But they wrote an entire book about what they thought was going to happen when Melchizedek came, the Messiah came. Was it one person, two people? Was that the same as teacher of righteousness? You know, that debate goes on, but you know, they did have this idea of somebody coming. That's why when they, you know, John and others get questioned, you know, are you? You know, the Jews understood something was about to happen. Okay, we're already past our time, so thank you for your attention.